talk. He teaches in the Department of Political Science at Queens College, CUNY. He's published articles on Max Weber, Ernst Bloch, and Tung. Additionally, much of his work is focused on genocide and the Holocaust, highlighted by his role, along with Alan Rosenberg, of the 1997 volume, Martin Heidegger and the Holocaust, which contains essays examining Heidegger's relationship to the industrialization of death as symbolized by Auschwitz. Professor Milchman is also a contributor and editor, also along with Alan Rosenberg, of a work entitled Postmodernism and the Holocaust, which examine how postmodern thinkers, including Arendt, Levinas, Foucault, Lyotard, and Derrida, have grappled with the historical bases, implications, and methodological problems of the Holocaust. Professor Milchman's latest book he edited, published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2003, is entitled Foucault and Heidegger, Critical Encounters. This volume contains contributions exploring the complexity of the two thinkers' relation and their relevance to questions about truth, nihilism, acquiescence and resistance, technology and agency, that are all still central categories of debates in contemporary thought. So we're especially excited to discuss tonight's paper, which is entitled, of course, Modern Social Theory and the Project of the Abolition of Labor, which has been a key and consistent concern for many of us in this workshop. So the way it works, Professor Milchman, is usually you would just introduce, I guess, how the paper fits into maybe a broader project that you're working on, or maybe concerns that didn't make it into the paper. So for about 5 to 10 minutes, and then we'll just field.
That's fine. Well, there are broader concerns because the paper leads in several directions, but the focus of it is this whole idea of the abolition of labor, which is not limited to Marx. It permeates, I think, the socialist movement, and I put in a short piece on Wilhelmine social theory because I think it rears its head there. I think you can find issues related to the abolition of labor, for example, in thinkers as diverse as Werner Zumbaut, Ferdinand Ternes, Max Weber, and Georg Simmel. But my focus, although you can take it wherever you wish when we start talking, but my focus is on Marx. The young Marx, certainly as early as the Paris manuscripts of 1844, saw the abolition of labor as the task of communism. And as the quotation that I've used from a work of 1845, in response to Friedrich List's work in political economy shows, the citation ends with these words, "Hence the abolition of private property will become a reality only when it is conceived as the abolition of labor, an abolition which of course has become possible only as a result of labor itself." And yet, there seems to be a contradiction in Marx, because by the time we get to Kapital and Volume 1, Marx is speaking of labor as the universal condition for the metabolic interaction between man and nature. And it seems that at that point, for Marx, labor will be with us as it has always been with us. It's ineradicable. And yet, I would argue that if we take a look at Marx's vast manuscripts for his Critique of Political Economy, most of which never were published until recently in the new Mega, although earlier there was the Grundrisse, but basically that doesn't make its appearance until the 50s. I mean, the 1939 edition of the Grundrisse, the original edition, did not come at a propitious time in Russia. I can't imagine there were many people studying it when it first appeared. God knows how many copies there were. I know that Roman Rostovsky must have put his hands on one, but still in all, you could lump together all of these manuscripts, and some of them only really recently published, Volume 3 of Kapital, for example, the manuscripts were only published in the last few years, and we still do not have an English translation of them. We do have an English translation of the whole of the 1861-1864 manuscript, but how many people have worked over them is debatable. It seems to me that if you take the whole of Marx's manuscripts for the Critique of Political Economy, you come away with a clear impression that the abolition of labor, about which Marx spoke in 1844, 1845, is still present, that there may be no contradiction between the young and the later Marx. But whether there's a contradiction or not, my argument would be that someone working on these manuscripts today can certainly see how the abolition of labor fits into a reading of Marx. I would argue that, as I now switch to a later Marx, the Marx of 1875, the Critique of the Goethe Program. Everyone's familiar with it. It's the famous text in which Marx outlines a lower and a higher stage of communism. And my argument is that in this lower stage of communism, the dictatorship of the proletariat, the value form remains intact. Wage labor remains intact. I would argue capitalism remains intact. You can't eradicate capitalism without the abolition of labor, without the overthrow of the value form. And Marx doesn't see that in the Critique of the Goethe Program. As important as that text was in the struggle within the German workers' movement in 1875, today it is a piece of history, not a program for communism. Several texts after the Russian Revolution develop the ideas contained in the Critique of the Goethe Program, furthering them. I speak of the Fundamental Principles of Communist Production and Distribution, which was a text of the German-Dutch left in the late 1920s, and certain texts within the Italian communist left, particularly those by Jacques Camat, which have been translated into English. But in all of these texts, which really date from the period of the 30s through the 70s, The idea remains that in the period of transition, the value form will, in some sense or other, remain intact, because remuneration for the workers, the amount that the workers get to eat, is strictly determined by how much labor they perform, generally through labor vouchers of some kind, which entitle you to take from the general storehouse exactly as much as you have put into it through your labor, measured again by socially average labor time. And my basic argument, and I hope that's what we focus on, is that it is precisely that period of transition which is an obstacle to communization today, and which in an epoch when capitalism is in a long-term crisis, probably a crisis from which it cannot easily or perhaps ever emerge, that to speak of a period of transition in which one preserves the value form, however modified it is itself an obstacle to the very development that the situation today demands. So that's the way I would outline the basic paper. The only thing I would add is there is a distinction that has to be made, and I don't think it's simply a linguistic distinction, between labor and work, between Arbeit and Werk. And I think it's an important distinction, because there's a tendency to, and I think even Marx fell into this, to see labor as transhistorical in nature and not historically specific, and to run labor and work together, when in fact the distinction has to be drawn between the two, lest we fall back into the value form. I'm arguing that labor is historically specific to capitalism. There are other forms of labor, and I mentioned them in the paper, but all of them are historically specific and not trans-historical in nature. But what I'm trying to at least introduce is the idea of work beyond labor. And it's just at the germinal stage here. But it does have some roots in German social theory. Both Hannah Arendt and Jürgen Habermas make such distinctions. But my argument in this paper is that they don't see the necessity for the abolition of labor. They simply see that labor has to exist side by side with action and interaction and communicative interaction, lest labor take over the whole of what Habermas calls the Lebenswelt. I think that that doesn't go far enough, that it shortchanges what the historical situation demands. So that's the synopsis of the paper.
So I guess we'll just open it up.
I'm curious, Thierry Communiste and Roland Simon are cited in this paper, mm-hmm. And their whole conception of the programmatic labor movement is really crucial to their sense of what communization is. That mm-hmm. there was a programmatic labor movement up until the restructuring of the 70s, which was based in the self-affirmation of the working class, which according to them always held the seeds for counter-revolution within it, insofar as the affirmation of one pole, mm-hmm. the capital-labor relation. Something changed in the 70s that doesn't make that a viable or even an evident form of struggle on the ground today, particularly. So I guess I'm just curious if you endorse that historicization, that we can only really think the abolition of labor, some sort of immediate communization, in the current moment.
Well, I would say two things. Immediate raises all sorts of questions. I mean, several of the theorists of communization make a distinction between the instantaneous and the immediate. Immediate steps, the end of wages, whether it's in the form of labor vouchers or monetary wages, that would have to happen very, very quickly as the some of the first steps of a process of communization. But it doesn't entail a snap of one fingers or the waving of a magic wand, because we live in a world where the tasks of implementing communization are nothing less than Herculean. But to get back to the first point, I have no idea how I would have reacted were I to have been alive in 1848 or in 1875. I probably would have been a programmatist, as Thierry Communiste sees it. But since you can't leap over your own shadow, it's difficult for me to say more than that. What I would say is that what Thierry Communiste saw in the 1970s, the end of Fordism, definitively, seems to me to mark a rupture. And it's that rupture that I think communization theory arises from in all of its different forms. I don't even know if Marx's manuscripts had been available 60 or 70 years ago, whether we would have read them in the same way that Moish obviously read them, or that I'm reading them today. Probably not. I don't know if that answers.
Sure, yeah.
I had a somewhat related question about vis-a-vis your remarks in the beginning about what you see as the major obstacle today to a process of communization. And I guess I wanted to hear more about this distinction between instantaneous and immediate. Is that the right term, immediate?
Okay.
Because I thought, Chris, and you said this yourself, right, on 5, there's kind of this really hard critique against the theory of or concept of transition, right? Mm-hmm. Because isn't the precise point of communization that it tries to overcome the idea that there are certain steps and or phases that one must go through, that communization is the process It is not a, I guess, a door towards, I don't know, post-capitalism. It is, in fact, post-capitalism. Mm-hmm. The process is the result, right? Isn't this the kind of one of the main strengths of the idea? So I'm just curious about this. First, the distinction between instantaneous and whatever its corollary would be, and the idea of transitions.
Well, whatever a world that was communist might or might not look like, I think the distinction that I'm trying to get at is that the abolition of the value form and the abolition of wage labor cannot wait until the end of a period of transition, long or short as it may be. That these have to be immediate steps, and unless they are, then one cannot talk about the end of capitalism or even the dangers of a restoration of capitalism, because capitalism hasn't been destroyed, it hasn't been overthrown. Whatever the political forms that we might speculate will be, workers' councils, we can talk about that. And I guess the answer is I'm not into blueprints, but I am trying to draw a distinction. And I think, for example, Bruno Astarian, whose works I think get close to this, is a figure that I would point to. For him, communism is not the end of production. It's the end of a certain kind of production. It's the end of productivity, the measure of which is socially necessary labor time. And that means, I think, the value form, and that means, I believe, capitalism. But production doesn't come to an end. Its modes, its forms change. There will be material production under communism. There will be the production of the social individual, the production of the person, of the self, the self-creation. Production is not something that one has to reject in the name of communism. What one has to reject is the production based on this idea of productivity and the value form. Now, how we get to that, that's another question, and perhaps we can talk about that. But I don't know, have I answered your...
I mean, certainly, I agree, without a doubt, but maybe to ask it in a different way. I guess what is for you, at least, like the, I don't know, theoretical purchase of a theory of communization for our moment, right? And so this is related to a question of, on the bottom of page 2-3, this sentence here about, however radical Marx's prescription seemed in 1875, today in the capitalist world, where the social reproduction of the proletariat is now threatened by the capitalist social relation and the very existence of the value form. Mm-hmm. Such a vision seems inaccurate. I mean, what I guess is new about this threat and or constitutive contradiction? And secondly, what is it about communization that I guess is peculiarly, I don't know, appealing and or rich, given our like contemporary moment?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the things is that we now live in an epoch, and I'd be prepared to even call it an epoch, in which the very development of capitalism has now expelled from the labor process such masses of workers and potential workers that the reproduction of the proletariat, however one wants to define it, is now in question, even globally. And despite all of the talk about what's happening in China or what's happening in India or in the other BRICS, the fact remains that capitalism today no longer requires masses of labor power. That's one of its accomplishments. But it also is a death sentence for masses of human beings on a scale that I don't think we appreciated until the present epoch. I mean, after all, the Fordist epoch only came to an end in the 1970s or so. I mean, in the 1970s, in Germany, in France, they were still importing workers, and not to do the jobs that native workers wouldn't do, but to do the jobs for which there was a huge need that could not be filled by native workers. So Algerians went into the Citroën and Peugeot plants. in France, and Turks went into the Volkswagen plants and the Mercedes plants in Germany. That era died in the 1970s, and I would say that ever since then, slowly but certainly, and particularly since the crisis of 2008, we've seen a heightened process of the expulsion of vast numbers of workers who are simply superfluous for the needs of capitalism, no matter how low their wages might be. And I think that has created, to use an old expression, a new ball game. Whether or not we could have anticipated that or seen it, I think a lot of it comes from the fact that nobody necessarily talks about it. It may link up with my own writings on the Holocaust, which is not to say that the aim of the Holocaust was to reduce superfluous labor, but it created a situation, two world wars, the Holocaust, in which there was such a shortage of labor that for a period of 20 years after the war, jobs were plentiful. I mean, all you had to do was look around countries like the United States or Germany or France or Italy, and the problem was not the superfluity of labor. The problem was of a different nature. Today, it is the superfluity of labor, and I would say in relative terms, this is already apparent in places like Brazil and China, because I have very little hope that China and Brazil are going to replicate what happened in the West 100 years ago, or even during the period of Fordism. I think they are based on bubbles, not unlike the bubble that we saw in this country in 2008. And if it comes down to investment advice, I guess my feeling would be don't invest in China and don't invest in Brazil unless you want to lose your shirt. But maybe that goes too far in answering your question.
I was curious about, you talk about page, what is it? Six, about a vision, so that accompanying any sort of anti-labor consciousness would have to be a kind of vision for an alternative. And I was linking that prospect up with what you mentioned in terms of looking at forms of exploitation, so looking at historically over the long durée, labor historically and as a form of exploitation. And so you go back and talk about different forms of slavery and such in China and so on and so forth. I was curious if in the sort of look back to forms of exploitation, to labor, the category of labor as a form of exploitation historically, at the same time that you're looking back to that as a form of exploitation, the vision, the alternative, I was curious, are there ways in which you also are looking back to other times, other epochs historically, where you're saying that the vision that needs to be articulated is also somehow maybe connected in what the conditions of possibility at certain times historically? Or is that vision something that can only emerge in the praxis of communization in real time?
I would think the latter. But I'm well aware of the fact that as horrific as the exploitation of historically specific modes of labor may have been, whether it was in feudal Europe or in Ming China, there were aspects of production and customs and traditions that are not unpalatable to someone who lives in a world where labor consumes one 24/7 and where you must be trained for labor from the earliest childhood, even if it's modes of labor that no longer have anything to do with the Fordist factory. But I am not someone who believes that the path to the future lies in romantic anti-capitalism. I think there are interesting elements because they point towards modes of human praxis or poesis or production that have been excluded or eliminated by the development of capitalism to the point where they have become so marginalized that we can only think about them as having existed in a distant past. But I think that the modes of production that I'm talking about, the kinds of praxis poesis that I'm talking about, are not a replication of modes of production that existed in the past.
So in the same sense that labor as as an historically specific category, you would say that the work or production
would not be equally historically specific. Yes, because it wouldn't be accompanied by, I mean, if I think back to Rabelais' description of life in Renaissance France, some of which seems mighty appealing to me. I mean, the carnival and so on and so forth. And I think about Bakhtin's work on it. You could say, well, there's a model for the future, but it's hardly a model for the future, in my humble opinion, simply because for most human beings, a life expectancy in the 20s or early 30s, the level of disease, I don't think it marks a utopia in any sense of the word. But I think there are certain elements of production then that could, under very different conditions and in very different modes, be something that we could anticipate in the future. But it would not be going back to the past.
Could I follow up with a question?
By all means.
Okay, so there's also a point at the end of the piece that you talk about the development of consciousness that could then explode the value form.
Mm-hmm.
And so based on what you're saying right now, then with these sort of this Bakhtinian dialogical form, like that took place in the marketplace for Bakhtin,
mm-hmm.
In terms of, say, social movement politics in the present, to the extent that social movement politics relies on kind of similar sites of resistance and invokes maybe even some of these older forms, not sometimes nostalgically, sometimes reflexively, critically,
mm-hmm.
however it may be. Do you, I mean, because what I find in the piece is that there's a kind of way in which there's a kind of an historicist argument that's being pushed and then being pulled against continuously,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't clear at the end kind of where you were coming down in terms of kind of the stages qualities.
Mm-hmm.
It feels to me very much like you're sort of maybe wanting to push against it, but there's a way in which it's being used at the same time. And so it seems to me like even in the way that you've answered this question, that there may be a kind of way in which these older forms produce conditions of possibility, at least in terms of social imaginaries, and you mentioned that,
mm-hmm.
That then could produce other forms of consciousness that could lead to an explosion. So maybe you could talk, just about that.
Well, I can, I guess. I'm actually pointing explicitly in the paper when I introduce the objective real possibility of communization today to modes of activity or praxis that exist in capitalism in the present time, not residues of earlier forms. But you raise an interesting point, so it must be the Blochian in me. Certainly Ernst Bloch saw, for example, in the world of Thomas Munzer and the peasant wars in Germany, something that might in a very different way be replicated in his present time. And I'm not averse to certain elements, but it does not have the historicist thrust that I think you may be attributing to me, although I will be careful when I want to publish this. Because it may be there in some subterranean form, so I need to be careful. But I have tried to expunge any hint of historicism. My view is not one of stages, either stages where one looks backward or stages where the inevitability of communism arises from the present stage of capitalism. I don't see an inevitability of communism, unfortunately. I see a possibility of communism, and I am trying to locate what Bloch calls the objective real possibility of communization. But the idea of a series of stages, a trans-historical philosophy of history, which I think traditional Marxism contains, is one that I reject. I don't think it exists. I mean, Paul Maddock, whom I cite in his preface to the republication of the Fundamental Principles of Communist Production and Distribution, back in the 1930s, early 30s, he wrote a pamphlet, the title of which was The Inevitability of Communism. I don't think there ever was an inevitability of communism. I don't think there is an inevitability of communism. And if I were a betting man, I wouldn't give great odds on it, because one can easily imagine or anticipate a very different kind of world than communism emerging from the world in which we live today, one that would come closer to Rosa Luxemburg's image of barbarism. I particularly see this in the growth of nationalism and xenophobia and retrogressive ideologies based on religion. So I'm not someone who takes comfort in this image of the inevitability of communism. I wish I could, but to me it seems like a religious imaginary, and I gave that up long ago. So if there are historicist elements in the sense in which you're using the term, I need to be careful, but that was not my intention. Does that help?
Sure.
Okay.
So I have a quick question in response to your engagement with Fabian a second ago. So am I right in understanding that the point is that the abolition of labor is a necessary condition for the occurrence of communization?
Mm-hmm.
Well, so I suppose I would wonder that if communism is contingent and not in any sense ineluctable, then what would be an alternative? Like, what would be an alternative that could occur after the abolition of labor that wouldn't be communism? I suppose I'm wondering why the process of the abolition of labor isn't itself communization, and if it's not communization, then I don't know what the other alternatives would be in a world without it.
No, I think the abolition of labor is communization. I don't think I was trying to say anything other than that. I thought you were leading in the direction of what would happen if there was not an abolition of labor or communization, if there was not a social movement that would overturn the value form. And I can anticipate several possibilities. But labor has assumed the historically specific form of abstract labor linked to value in this epoch. And its abolition is communization. I don't think there are then several pathways, although I admit I haven't thought about precisely what specific form such pathways might take. Perhaps I'm still under the influence of the prohibition against graven images. I don't know, but it's a possibility. I hesitate to paint a picture of communism, but I would say that the first step of any revolutionary movement has to be the abolition of labor, of the form in which the historically specific form in which labor has come to exist under capitalism. That means wage labor. That means the value form. That means labor measured by socially necessary labor time. It means primarily the subjugation of human beings to the clock, to a particular mode of time.
No, so I suppose I understand that. It's just in the way that, I'm trying to figure out where the disagreement, the ground of disagreement is, that the paper is sort of like intervening with, right? So it seems to me a little bit like, in that telling, then communization is simply an event rather than a process, right? And if it's a process, then one could imagine that process starting with something other than, like, because obviously the abolition of labor isn't just going to happen, right? And so there's got to be a sort of process through which that takes place.
There are two processes. One, and we can get into this, is how does one imagine a revolutionary process that would first topple the capitalist state and capitalist social relations? And then comes the process, because since I'm arguing that communization is not instantaneous, we live in a world where there are now millions of people who have been expelled from the labor process in one form or another. Peasants expelled from the land in large parts of the world. Wage workers expelled from the factories in other parts of the world. And the question is, what will they do and how will they be fed? And isn't there an enormous task ahead just to take care of the most basic needs of human beings? So that's another process. But I'm arguing that that process cannot begin without the abolition of wage labor. It can't begin on the basis of wage labor. But the other question, how would such a revolutionary process occur? I mean, one of the arguments of the communizers, or communisateur, I can't pronounce it in English very easily, for some reason it slips off the tongue. But one of the arguments of the communisateur is that there is a revolutionary subject. And I don't think they have broken clearly with the idea of who is this revolutionary subject. Clearly, they reject the idea of a republic of labor, the old idea that the proletariat will seize power and nationalize the means of production, and in some form or another, this will be the period of transition to communism. I don't think that's the case. I think that creates a form of bureaucratic state capitalism, whatever term you want to use for it. It creates precisely what happened in Russia in 1917, or in China in 1949, or in Cuba in 1958, or in Vietnam in the early 70s. And it leads perhaps back to neoliberalism, because that's where it has led in Vietnam. Or in Russia, or it may still exist in a modified form in which the state plays a dominant role, as is the case in China. But it doesn't lead to communism, in my opinion. It leads away from communism. It is an effort to stabilize capitalism. But if the subject of revolution is not some trans-historical subject as the proletariat is conceived of, the heir of all the other exploited classes in history that finally makes the revolution, where does this process occur in the present time? And one of the things I'm trying to point to in the last paragraph, and I admit I haven't developed it in this paper, is that one has to look at the changes in the point of production today, because in order for capitalism to exist and continue to eliminate labor power from the production process, a certain amount of creativity has to exist at the point of production, whether it's in Silicon Valley or someplace else. Now there it exists, I would argue, under the subjugation of the value form. I mean, just look at Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook. It seems to me a pretty good example. On the other hand, some of the ideas that go into it in Silicon Valley are ideas that could lead to communization, that could be exemplars of communization. And one of the things I'm trying to reach towards when I talk about the objective real possibility of communization and allude to Ernst Bloch is the possibility that within the labor process, in its most advanced forms in capitalism today, even though it involves only a small minority of workers, there are anticipations of, or possibilities, or germs of, what could be communization.
And that sounds, to me, that sounds, and maybe a misunderstanding, sounds like the old story of the forces of production overthrowing the relations of production, rather than, you know, there's this other possibility of the way the capital throws off labor, which you're describing, that, and I think, you know, you're quoting Petra Ostrom's Crisis and Communization piece, and I haven't read that piece, but from the quotations from it, like, I get the sense that he's locating communization precisely just an acute need on behalf of people, you know, that aren't, that capitalism itself destroys the labor process, can't reproduce, mm-hmm. you know, a proletariat, and then, you know, communization is the immediate act of, you know, acquiring goods for needs and destroying the value form. I guess on the face of it, that strikes me as distinct from, and, you know, maybe compatible with, but distinct from the question of what is, how is production, capitalist production itself, going to imminently create communization. And, you know, the kind of cast off, no longer proletarian, I mean, that's there in the Communist Manifesto as well. I mean, Marx talks mm-hmm. about the secular tendencies, the surplus population. So I'm very sympathetic to Theories Communiste's idea of, you know, of the self-affirmation of a programmatic proletariat not being available in the same way after Fordism. But nevertheless, you know, this kind of self-destruction of the proletariat is there in the 19th century as well. There is that rhetoric.
Well, the problem I see, and I will be as brief as I can be on this front, because we're into terra incognita here, it seems to me. Hopes, dreams, real possibilities, I hope, I think, I believe. But how to work them out. But the reason I objected to the point that to which you allude is that, first of all, it seems to be deterministic. Capitalism has created such a crisis that communism becomes ineluctable and inevitable. And I see other pathways out of that are far darker than communization, far more threatening than communization. So I wanted to point to a reaffirmation of another deterministic vision. The crisis of capitalism will be so deep that those who are thrown off the labor force, who are expelled from the labor force, will have no other alternative than to make a revolution. I think that's a hope and a dream that I just don't see the purchase for it, because I can anticipate other possibilities in the direction of nationalism, xenophobia, statism, bureaucratization, that are, as I said, far darker. But I am certainly not saying that capitalism produces in some automatic or ineluctable or inevitable way the subject that will overturn. But I think that it's within the capitalist labor process that one has to look to for some elements, because capitalism has not reached this point in which it has expelled so large a percentage of the population from the labor process without calling upon certain elements of creativity that may themselves be anticipations of what communism might look like. But of course, those elements of creativity are marginal in capitalism, and they are subjugated to the value form. But nonetheless, it seems to me that that kind of intelligence, that kind of creativity, call it artistic, call it technical, call it what you will, may contain seeds from which a break with capitalism, a revolutionary break with capitalism, can arise. It's not the thrust of the paper. It's one element with which I am involved in right now. But it's very different from this idea that communization simply arises from the desperation of the masses who have been so traumatized by the crisis of capitalism. And the reason I hesitate to place any faith in that is that a great deal of faith was placed in that after 1929. And it led, in places like Germany, to the very opposite. And I'm not sure that similar tendencies are not unfortunately alive and well in contemporary capitalism, and very, very threatening.
So you mentioned it at one point on page six, you talk about the, you know, anti-labor must be accompanied by a vision of human activity praxis, which encompasses the realm of production, freedom, its historical, including its capitalist integument. You just mentioned creativity, like what you see in Silicon Valley. I've heard as an example of somewhere where that potentiality for a transformed conception of like production without productivity might be located. So I'm wondering, I'm really trying to get a conversation started, since I'm sure you're aware that someone in this room has argued in print that forcefully that the entire industrial mode of production itself is also molded in the form of capital, and that various capacities, scientific, intellectual, and whatnot, are also then, you know, in alienated or exist in a form that, as presently constituted, are molded by capital. And it seems like you're gesturing towards that idea, so I'm wondering, could we talk a little bit about any anticipation of what would this shift from, you know, this sort of creative use of science, which it sounds like you're gesturing towards, what might that look like, or what would that mean in terms of the actual material mode of production and the extent to which it would be transformed under this, you know, this sort of non, you know, non-capitalist, non-alienated form of production?
Well, in contrast to traditional Marxism, I fervently believe that technology and science, modern science, are yoked to the value form, emerge with it, are inseparable from it. The idea of the neutrality of science and technology, which I think traditional Marxism has based itself on. We overthrow the capitalist state, but we utilize the technology and science that capitalism has given us to construct communism, is a fundamental mistake, because it doesn't see the link between the value form and the historical development of modern science and technology. But that doesn't mean that we will not be the beneficiaries in some sense of the potential that existed in that technology. We're not going to go back to the Stone Age. We're not going to go back to Rabelais' world. We're not going to leap forward to Woodstock. I think I allude to it somewhere in the paper. And because, you know, when I talk to people, including Comunista Tour, very often they say, you know, you want to know what communism is like? It's Woodstock. And of course they weren't at Woodstock, but neither was I. I missed it. Not because I wasn't around. I was around. But I didn't choose to go there, because I don't like mud, and I had a young baby, and I didn't want to smoke that much weed. But putting that aside, which is coincidental, it seems to me that this Woodstock image reappears over and over again as the ideal. This is what communization is. We'll all lie around, we'll smoke a lot of weed, have a lot of sex, and you know, it's not that hard to grow weed, and food. Well, I guess we can go to people like Adani to help us with that. But it's not really the problem. I mean, to me, the idea that that is what communization is an obstacle to communization. It's the kind of illusion or dream one has precisely because you're smoking weed. And I have no objection to smoking weed, but I wouldn't want to write a paper or give a talk on communization while I was smoking weed. So does that help?
It points
but
to
it
direction,
may not set
yeah.
It may not set up the argument you want. I'm just not sure about that. I have a sense that maybe the argument that you want is lying there somewhere, but I'm not sure that this is it.
Could I ask one more, maybe a more specific, different question? But so you mentioned like Silicon Valley as an instance of where you maybe see something percolating. Could you maybe elaborate on that a little bit? Like, what is it about? What's different in what you're seeing? Or you can pick a different example if that's a bad one. But like, what are the pointers that you observe there that look like something fundamentally different?
I guess I would say, and it's not really Silicon Valley to which I would point, it might even have elements in the hackers movement. I can see the potential for certain developments, for a world of production without productivity, in incipient forms there. But I have to admit, you are looking at someone, I mean, just to give you a concrete example, in a couple of days, I'm going to have to print out my e-ticket back to New York, okay? But I don't have a computer with me, okay? And when I printed out my original e-ticket, I couldn't do it myself. I needed someone to help me. So I belong to an age before there were computers, and I am very uneasy and actually frightened to death of much of this. So to talk about the hackers movement as containing certain potential is an anomaly, to say the least. It would sort of be like some indigenous member of a Stone Age tribe trying to explain Fortis production a couple of hundred years ago. It would have been difficult at best. So you've caught me at my weak point. It's very difficult for me to talk about what potential may lie in, for example, the hackers movement. But I am told by people in it that such a potential may exist. And perhaps you can help me with my e-ticket, and we can continue the discussion.
Thank you.
You know, this.
Go ahead.
Just one last follow-up on that. Is the potential, at least insofar as you're thinking of or conceiving of it now, is it a self-conscious understanding of the mode of production within some of these communities of hackers as being a kind of post-labor? Or is it a sense of which they're not fully conscious of precisely what they're doing, but it's a kind of symptomatic response to, and so there's a way in which there's a politics that, or a prefigurative politics that's articulated by those kinds of relations that you're seeing potentiality in. So it's not a, like, because you raise the question of consciousness. It seems mm-hmm. to be so pivotal to your
argument. It is.
So I'm curious, like, then if you're going to invoke the hackers as an example. But where does the question of consciousness come in to the picture?
There? Well, it wasn't, and I really will be brief, but it wasn't primarily over the question of hackers or Silicon Valley or anything of that sort when I raised the question of consciousness, but I will come back to that in a moment. As I just said, if you ask the specifics about what I see in the hackers movement, I will have to call in people I know who could explain it far better than I. I would imagine free use is already a blow against the value form. But on the other hand, I see how Linux has been appropriated for commercial reasons, and so I'm leery of people who say, well, it's free use, so therefore it's communism, because it obviously isn't. But the consciousness I was really talking about is I cannot imagine communization occurring until or unless there is a recognition of what the value form is. And that recognition is not only not automatic or implicit in the life of a worker, but it requires a theoretical leap, the beginnings of which we are just at, perhaps, today. Because even those who see themselves as laboring, that's a word, working, shall I say, I'll expunge the word laboring here, working in the vineyard of communization, are only neophytes in Marx's manuscripts. I think the germs of an understanding of the value form are there, but it certainly has to be developed and elaborated in a way that is accessible to people who look at the world and say, how can we continue to exist in a world where, on the one hand, everything depends on labor, and on the other hand, there is no labor for increasingly large masses of human beings. And it's that theoretical breakthrough that we're missing, because progressives, socialists, the left still live in a world shaped by the value form and see the problem as Paul Krugman does. You know, all that has to happen is we have to regulate capitalism better. We have to eliminate the power of Wall Street. We have to print that trillion-dollar coin, and we can solve all of the problems of the capitalist world. I mean, that is where the dialogue is at as far as much of the progressive left, even leftist world, I mean, even Trotskyists sometimes speak in precisely that language. And to me, the first step has to be overcoming that, because it is an obstacle, because it perpetuates instead of abolishing the value form. It bases itself on the continuation of the value form, when the theoretical breakthrough has to be seeing what the value form represents, how it permeates every facet of human existence, how it has indeed subjugated the Lebensweit, whatever Habermas may have thought or may still think, the space in which the value form has not yet subjugated human existence has shrunk to the point of virtual non-existence today. And that theoretical point, I would argue, is absolutely crucial and a primary task of anyone who's interested in communism.
It seems to me, and this is sort of a very indirect point, that I was thinking when you mentioned Woodstock, that the statement by Marx about labor as a eternal condition, it depends how one takes labor, mm-hmm. but is exactly an argument against a notion of communism as play. Because that presupposes that somewhere else the interaction between humans and nature is taking place. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't enter the sphere of what you think about, so we're all having a good time. And that is sort of separate, but it seems to me that in the paper, the real difficulty of the conceptual tasks in front of us are given by the fact that half the people with whom you're in dialogue continue to see the essential problem as one of distribution. Whether it's the distribution of work or the distribution of goods, or whether it's the distribution of time, these numerous funny money schemes that are all kind of basically Proudhonist. Mm-hmm. And that there would be an emphasis on distribution is also very understandable. I mean, as you said several times, and correctly so, you know, we're dealing with a situation where unprecedented numbers of people are being ejected from the process of production. Whether it's agricultural production, industrial production, and that unlike a situation that may have existed to some degree in Europe in the 19th century, there is no possibility of mass emigration. I mean, in a real sense, in the fact that there are 10 times as many Irish Americans as Irish, literally says something about it's not just a very small minority of Europeans went and conquered the entire world. Europe was bursting at the seams, and the safety valve was the United States, Australia, South Africa, Canada, Argentina, etc., etc. But that kind of safety valve doesn't exist. And it becomes very understandable why there would be a great deal of emphasis on getting employment for everyone, getting the basic needs satisfied for everyone, because it's nothing. And it's very difficult to imagine, and I don't think any of us really have, how one mediates those real issues of distribution with that, and you and I completely agree here, the value form isn't just a category of exchange and distribution. It molds science, technology, and production. And so it's not a matter of using the same mode of production and just now spreading it more evenly. And it seems to me that's the real, that's a real serious theoretical task, and not, this isn't a criticism. You know, it's not that I have it in my hip pocket, and I'm going to pull it out. And it does seem to me that the issue of the focus of the paper on transition, and correct me if I'm wrong, that, of course, to come back to a statement that was made, communism doesn't just happen all at once, it has to be a process. The problem with whatever Marx meant in 1875, in the critique of the Goethe program, is that it became used as an ideology to justify, as socialist, what is essentially a process of national capital accumulation. Mm-hmm. And it was, to varying degrees, successful as national capital accumulation. One could even make an argument that national capital accumulation was something positive. It just sort of, I think, absolutely deformed the consciousness of three generations of most leftists who regarded that as being socialism, or in any way post-capitalist, since it was essentially a different road to a different form of capitalism. So that to the degree to which the idea of the two stages lent itself to this kind of use, whatever Marx was thinking, to that degree it really has to be sort of pushed away, and in a sense to clarify the history of the 20th century, because we can't move forward in the 21st if the 20th remains under this ideological veil. So I agree with that completely, but I think that's a separable issue, at least conceptually, from the one of how do we mediate, or even conceptually, the idea of a fundamental transformation of labor, you could call it work, poiesis, and at the same time address these issues of the enormous skewing of the distribution of goods, of labor, of time, of everything. So it's not something I expect now a 25 word or minute, you know, response to, but that was my reactions to the paper. So for me, it's productive.
Well, I think you've laid out the task very well, and I'm in complete agreement with you. One point, because I'm not looking for disagreements, although I don't mind them, but it seems to me that the success of this national capitalist development that you speak of is, A, it was not inevitable, I think, but B, it was bought at an enormous price.
I agree.
I mean, the impact of Stalinism, and I would see the seeds of Stalinism in Leninism, the impact of the so-called Chinese Revolution and Maoism, in terms of simply the numbers, it begins to come, it almost, I would hesitate to make such an argument, but because it sounds too dramatic, but it almost makes the Holocaust pale in comparison, just in the numbers, who died, who were worked to death, who went into the gulag and never came out, who were the victims of the collectivization or the mass starvation that began in the Ukraine. And we could then, I mean, my own experience, I remember the first march on the Pentagon. You might not have been there, you might have been in Germany at that
time. No, I was.
Were you there?
Yeah.
I'm sorry we didn't meet.
That was instead of Woodstock.
That was instead of Woodstock. Exactly. But I remember all of those people who were marching under the banners of the NLF.
Yes.
And for whom Ho Chi Minh represented the hopes of humankind. And when I think about it now, I'm really sick, because it almost replicated what happened in 1914, when, as far as millions of socialist workers were concerned, millions of trade unionists were concerned, if you were in Germany, the enemy was France. If you were in France, the enemy was Germany. And here it was at the March on the Pentagon, and the enemy was the United States. And I remember people saying to me, you know, I hope 20,000 American soldiers are killed. I hope the NLF gets them all. I hope they're wiped out to the last man. And I tried to think, is this what French and German workers were saying in 1914? Of course it is, unfortunately. That's why World War I was such a bloodbath, because that was the state of mind of millions of workers. Okay, it wasn't millions of workers in this country, perhaps, at the time of the March on Washington, but it was the student movement for its immense majority. And it's recognizing what this national development has meant in country after country over the past 70 or 80 years, that it's possible to see that it wasn't simply a detour from the path to communism. It was, to use an old-fashioned phrase and one that's probably been overworked, the counter-revolution. And it's a path that has to be recognized, I think, for what it was. Because, I would argue, unlike the development of capitalism in the 18th and 19th century, I'm not sure there was an alternative at that time. I don't want to jump over my own shadow into the past and tell you there was. I don't think it was Fourier's play or utopian socialist communes, but I think there was an alternative in the 20th century. But we missed that. And so here we are, still in the early stages of the 21st century. Are we going to miss it again? Because the implications are just even more horrendous than they were in 1914.